What's going on, everyone? Today we're talking with Hakoden, the director behind Zimmers of Southall, a short documentary film about the intergenerational subculture of classic car enthusiasts and their love for dub reggae and sound system culture in West London. So first of all, welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on. You were like the first person to get in to say, oh yeah, I want to chat about this. So I was like, yeah, that's cool. Let's do it.
Thank you. I do appreciate being one of the first to have this discussion with you. There were two reasons, though, why I got in touch to do this. The first was because I want to continue to support grassroots projects within the community. We've obviously done a previous podcast about your other book, Bind. If people listening to this haven't heard that, please do go and listen to that. Secondly, though, it struck a personal chord. My dad used to have an old school red M5. We also grew up with a lot of reggae music. We still listen to a lot of reggae music. And both of those are obviously central themes to your documentary. And it's really interesting to see how, and also then explore why, these cultures originate, evolve, and how they're maintained. Now, starting with a documentary, how did the idea for it even come about?
I think for me, casting wasn't a big thing for me. Obviously, I like cars, but I was never really into them. And one of the guys, Dunmi, he messaged me saying, because I always share records, he goes, I've got a collection of records, do you want to buy some? So I went over to his house in Southall and we started chatting, and they're into reggae. So we started talking about reggae. I took one or two pictures. Then one day they're building their sound system, Vedic Roots, and they're based in Southall, heart of Southall. So he's like, just come round. I think it was Nagarkirtan in 2019, November. I went to Nagarkirtan, and I think then I went to their house afterwards. And then I went there, took the pictures, and then one guy called Indy gave me a lift. And actually, before this, whilst I've been documenting stuff, I just noticed that there was classic cars everywhere. Like, everyone had a BMW. Like, it was just actually insane. And then Indy gave me a lift to the station, and he goes, yeah, I've got a classic car. And I'm like, cool, would you mind me taking pictures one day? So we met up, I took pictures, and he goes, yeah, I can get a few other guys to come down as well. So he invited like a few other guys. Next thing you know, there's like 10 cars on like this shoot, and we're just driving around like this old, like one guy was like, I'm cool. Then like the youngest guy was like 21. So I think this is when I realized, okay, there's a bit of a generational thing as well, and like very Southall. And then the guy was like, yeah, I want some rolling shots. Could we like do some video? And I was like, cool. And then I was like, I'm going to make a documentary about this. And then I think as we started doing it, the theme of dub reggae started coming out, that literally everyone said they listened to like roots reggae, especially like Jah Shaka influenced, Abashanti, Channel One, that sort of vibe was very Southall. And obviously I think Tudor Rose, Southall Community Centre, this is where they used to have the raves back in the day. Like their parents, these people's parents would go to this, like how we are at our age, they went to these things, I guess, to obviously they united with the Caribbean community back in Southall, and also just, I guess, to express themselves and have a good time. And that's been passed down generation to generation.
Whilst working on this documentary, did you pick up on why reggae music resonated with them?
I think I'd have to probably ask some of the elders exactly why that happened and what are the reasons for that. But I guess in terms of the younger plot, I think it's something that they've inherited listening to or being that has been passed down. That's kind of part of that identity within Southall. And there's like a couple of songs that are like, when anyone gets a car in Southall, I don't know if it's a Southall, but they all play Rumours by Gregory Isaacs. Like, that's like the tune. Apparently, that's the tune you test your system on. So there's certain things that I guess have become part of the ritual and part of the identity of that lifestyle. That's kind of embedding that. And I guess also having the sound systems coming to Southall. I think one of the guys at the end, he touched on, I guess, that relationship with like Rastafarianism and Sikhi as well. So I've been to like see Jah Shaka with these guys as well, and they can wear their bug, like it's okay. Like, you can have your dastar because there's some sort of overlap, and the Rastas get that as well.
You're correct. There are certainly overlaps. And when I had the opportunity to go to Jamaica, the respect Jamaicans in general gave to me just due to having a turban and my hair was absolutely unparalleled. Now, I know your documentary focuses on Southall, but have you noticed this subculture anywhere else?
I think my, maybe a subtle observation that I've had, maybe also in East and maybe parts of Midlands, is a lot of the Kenyan people are really, I think a lot of them I have noticed have Kenyan heritage, are mechanics, or like that car history is in them for some reason, and they always aspire to have certain cars.
You're certainly right that there's a very strong tradition of motorsports racing in Kenya and amongst Kenyan Sikhs, the most famous being Jogindra Singh Bachhu, born in 1932 and famously known by his moniker, the Flying Sikh.
Did you ever push your car?
Push?
Accelerate faster?
Of course, I've ambitioned again. That's what you do.
This is why they call you the Flying Sikh.
Well, if you don't fly, you don't win.
I think one of the guys, he was in some way related to one of the rally drivers that was from Kenya. I think it's also to do with the status thing as well. I think a lot of the people that went over to Kenya and places like that maybe were a bit more affluent, and they had businesses, and when they came here, I guess they wanted to reestablish that sort of status here in some way. And I guess having a BMW, a brand new one, is a pretty big statement.
What is it about classic cars that those you spoke to love so much, and why that and not a modern car?
I think the other thing is, obviously because it's been passed down and I guess they've looked up to their parents or whatever, also gives them something to do and become something. So it's like the car is a space. So if you're living in Ireland with like three generations, or you feel like you're going to end up living in the same house, the car becomes your like space to express yourself, a place to like a safe space. This is like a place where you can cruise, you can put your identity into it, something you can work on becomes a skill. And I guess you can belong to like a wider group of people that have a similar interest. So I went to one place, it was the Ostedi Classic Car Club. And literally, in my whole life, everyone there was Punjabi, or not like a Sikh, Punjabi Sikh or Indian or something. Like in that car show, and it was crazy from like old to young generation. And they had some of the like most beautiful cars I've ever seen. And I had no idea it was that big. And it was all in West London and surrounding areas.
Did going to that car meet encourage you to work on the documentary?
So I think towards the end of filming this, we had already got some stuff, but somebody said to me, look, you need to come to this show. And I managed to find the three uncles that are in the picture of the poster. I spoke to them. They told me that they used to live in Southall on like Warwick Road, and like the story, and like they probably have the best looking car there. They're still into it. Like they clean like the engines and stuff. It's actually insane. And it's just like they all listen to reggae. Like it's just like that thing about cruising and that lifestyle. And I guess, yeah, it's just very deep rooted.
Would it be fair to say that these classic cars that are passed down within families almost act like a seal of approval and a continuation of a legacy?
Yeah, I think that's, I guess it's like continuing that, okay, this is who we are, this is what we do. The actual cars themselves, they actually hold, I'm not 100% sure, but they hold value. I guess it's become an investment. And a lot of the people, they pass the cars around. Oh yeah, they're like, oh, I sold this car to that guy. He lives on that street. So like people are like exchanging the cars within their circles in those areas as well. So people change cars, they get a new one. And yeah, I guess it's just part of that thing. So you can own one car for one time and then own another one. And it keeps value. It has its own economy as well.
That's amazing. Now, how long did it take and what did it entail to go from having all of this raw footage to producing the finished documentary?
So I think me and Sook started filming this like November 2020. We filmed it VHS and digital, but we didn't know what we were doing. We were just blagging it. I just wanted to make something and we had no idea what we were doing. Then I think the COVID thing happened. We couldn't go out. And then I guess summertime, I spoke to someone that I gave some photos for a different project. He makes films. His name's Alex from Alley Cat Films, and he's based in South London. And he'd seen some of the pictures, and he mentioned that he'd love to help. So at this point, I said, look, my friend's kind of busy. He doesn't really have time to finish this off. Do you want to get involved? He works in the like film industry, and he's connected to people. So I took them down. He bought a cameraman. We had one VHS camcorder this time, and I got the guys together. We properly recorded the interviews, done all the footage, started building this story, and we pretty much done it in like a month. Because I'd already put in the work and built relationships over, say, 2 years, it was just about planning it and making sure everyone was there at the right time. And that was it. And we actually finished this end of last year. Then we were just trying to get it to pitch to people to go out somewhere. And yeah, so I guess most of the work is building these relationships and getting to understand the culture. Then you understand what the story is. And I guess prior to this coming out, we also had an article with my friend Kieran, who wrote for Mixmag, and that kind of spoke more about the dub and sound system culture and how that related to the cars. And that was more of a focus on the music, whereas the piece in GQ spoke more about the cars. So yeah, that's kind of the timeline.
I love how it grew organically, and at the center of it is a want to portray stories as honestly as possible. And the documentary, in my opinion, certainly achieves that. What has the response been then since the documentary has been published?
I think in general, it has gone down like really, really well. And I don't usually post stuff on YouTube, but the comment section on YouTube is really good. So a lot of the people from that community have just been like, wow, this is spot on. This is what it feels like. And across different generations as well. So people feel proud. And yeah, I think everyone's relating to it. And even people that are not into cars or from our community have just loved it as well. So it's kind of connected across the board.
Are there plans to do a Zimmers of Southwold Part 2 or to explore this area any further?
So in terms of pictures, I can definitely say the picture series is not finished. So I wanted to release a zine along with this. But when I pull the photos together, I feel like the story was incomplete. So I will definitely try and finish the series off this year. I maybe release that as a zine. So yeah, let's just see what happens with that. In terms of the actual edit, I don't know. I think in my mind, there's definitely more there. There's still a few people I would have liked to include and a few more elements that I think can make this story richer. But we'll have to see what happens with that. And yeah, but if something does happen, I'll let you know.
Oh, please do. I would absolutely love that. And I'm sure others would too. Putting Zimmers of Southwold just to aside a second, what are your plans for the rest of the year? Are you working on any other projects?
So I think obviously first time I can say publicly is that the new book is coming in 2 months, and it's called Kasan, and it was shot at the farmers' protest over 24 hours. So that's the next book that's coming out.
Now, you've certainly caught my attention, and I'm sure those listening want to know more too. So could you explain a little bit more about how this book came about and what it contains?
So I think before I released Bind, I had a trip planned to Punjab to take the book back and give it to them, and they get it first. And that was delayed till last year. So I had no plans on shooting another book. And then we got there at like 3 a.m, and you drive past border, and it was just like, this is insane. Like you see it on social media and the news, and you're like, this is actually insane. And I was like, I'm gonna come back. And I decided there and then I'll make a book. I was like, I don't know how I'm gonna fund it, I don't know what I'm gonna do, but I'll take the pictures and see what happens when I come. So I think a week later, I went down with my mom, Maji. We stayed with the people from our Bind, the people that were in the book Bind as well. So it's kind of a continuation from that story. And we stayed the weekend, and I just took as many pictures as I could over those 24 hours and came home. And I guess there was a story there, and now it's going to be out in about 2 months.
As someone who experienced and witnessed Dickory Board at first hand, could you help paint a picture of what it was like for those listening?
I think you realise, okay, this is real. Like, the enormity of it and the size of the protest was just, it just went on. You're driving for like 15 minutes and it's just like the all the trolleys and the tents and shelters is just like going on and on and on. And it was about 10 miles, I think, in length, 16 kilometers. And I feel like I've never seen anything like that in my life, and most people haven't either. When you're actually there, there's also this feeling of something, of like something's happening and they're not going to go without achieving something. Like, regardless of if you agree with them or not, or whatever your political stance is, it's quite incredible that people have come down and literally just blocked the road and set up basically one giant bin there.
What was the general sentiment of those you interacted with at Dickory, and how did they respond to you coming from outside to see what was going on?
So I think when I got there, it was late, basically one day after the 1 year anniversary. And obviously people get fatigued. They do get fatigued. They get tired because it goes on for so long. But I think they had a bit of more energy, a bit more jarn in them, that they heard that this was going to end as well soon. And in terms of me being there, I think they were really, really welcome to that. So everyone wanted their picture taken. Like, it was the opposite. It's like, yeah, take my picture. I want my picture. Everyone wanted their picture taken. And this story to go out to the rest of the world. And I think they weren't going to leave there without victory. Like, that's, no matter what happened, they weren't going to leave. People were there for like nearly a year, and they're only going back home for like 2 months in the whole year. Or people would come on the weekends. People would come and stay for a week and send somebody else. And literally everyone was doing this. And yeah, there was a lot of unity. It was just good vibes.
You were literally recording history in real time, and I really look forward to the book. And I'm sure those listening will want to get their hands on a copy too.
And I guess the other thing was, if we, obviously there's, people have captured some of the most historical big moments that we'll remember forever. This is like the story of what it's like day to day and who are the people involved, and kind of like the organization and the logistics of how things were on a normal day. And it just shows that.
Why do you do the work that you do, whether that's Bind, Zimmers of Southall or Kasan?
I think the main thing, like, I maybe the reason why I documented this was that it's important to tell stories about now. And a lot of the stuff that we see about, I guess, Asians or apne or like whatever you want to say, is all about, always about the past and looking back. And there's like, there's no stories about now, especially like working class people. And it's just like more detailed stories that show a difference in who we are and people. And I guess this is like telling so many different stories that they kind of overlap each other to show who like community is. And I guess this is just one piece of a bigger picture.
Finally, for all those listening, if you want to watch the documentary Zimmers of Southall, you can find the link in the description, alongside the links to the GQ and Mixmag articles covering the documentary. Otherwise than that, don't forget to like, comment and subscribe. It really, really helps. And I will see you all in the next video.